And it is with extreme pleasure that I don't have to introduce him. You know him. Dr. Jack.
What does one say after an introduction like that? Except that it has been a great privilege and a pleasure for me to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you have made me a part. I think one of the proudest moments of my life was when at a general service conference several years ago they elected me an honorary alcoholic. I got back home and one of my medical friends who was a little bit on the WCTU side heard in a group one of our other friends asking me, well, what was this honor you just got? And I said so, and he said, huh, what's honorary about that? He didn't know. But thank you for inviting me down to this meeting, because it's been a real privilege and a real thrill for me to see so many of you that we spent two general service conferences with in New York. Lots of times as our paths have crossed since. And it's a real thrill to see you again, to have a chance to chat, shake hands, and be part of you. When this Delegate Southeastern Conference began many years ago, and I don't remember how many it was.
I actually started 58, so small week.
There was some resistance to the idea in some parts of the country. I think we owe a great deal to Jim for having the idea and promoting it. And I hope to see this develop all over the country. Because you people who have been in New York, who know what's there, and who know what's there because you're carrying the message so much here at home. And you have an opportunity and I think a responsibility to meet a need that I see, that many of you see in AA. What can we do to bring to other members of AA that have been in the fellowship 3, 4, 5, 6 years and they're beginning to drop away from it? I think there's no group that has the capacity, the opportunity, the dedication to AA and the older members that you have to think together of how we can do a better job to keep these older members of AA, to keep them growing, to provide in the meetings that we have the kind of interest, the kind of stimulation, the kind of dedication that you folks have, which will keep them aboard and will keep them where the newer members coming in need them. I hadn't planned to talk about that until I got toward the end of it. I'm going to do something tonight that I haven't done before. I hope you'll like it. But I have been coming in contact the last few months with a lot of early AA history. Much of it's in letter form, and rather than to try to pull out of these letters the things that to me seem interesting and important, I'm going to read them to you. I hope it won't be boring. To me, it's exciting, because I get the feel out of these letters of the people. And I thought that this group would be interested, fascinated as I have been, at what you find in the people in some of these letters. The minutes of the first meeting of the Alcoholic Foundation, 30 Rockefeller Plaza, New York City, April 11, 1938. In attendance were trustees William S. Richardson, Frank B. Amos, and William J. Riddell. A proxy from Dr. R.B. Smith of Akron, Ohio, is in the hands of Mr. Frank B. Amos, stating, "I hereby appoint Mr. W.S. Richardson to represent me at the meeting of the trustees of the Alcoholic Foundation," they called it the Alcoholic Foundation back then, "and to vote for me as he sees fit. I instruct him, however, to vote for Mr. Frank B. Amos for treasurer of said foundation." Trustee John E. F. Wood was absent. Mr. William S. Richardson acted as temporary chairman. It was moved and seconded that William J. Riddell be elected permanent chairman of the foundation, 3 votes being cast for William J. Riddell. It was moved and seconded that Mr. Frank B. Amos be elected permanent treasurer, Frank B. Amos receiving 3 votes. It was moved and seconded that A. Leroy Chipman, William G. Wilson, Albert L. Scott, and Henry G. Parkhurst serve on the advisory committee, 4 votes being cast in favor of the motion. Mr. Chipman and Mr. Parkhurst were present at the meeting. Mr. Chipman was treasurer of the Alcoholic Foundation when I first joined it. So many of these names bring the picture of a person to me. Mr. Amos asked Mr. Parkhurst to recount the work to date. The following report was made, 1938. In the eastern section, 41 alcoholics recovered, 6 alcoholics in the questionable class, 12 alcoholics upon whom a great deal of time has been spent, but so difficult that the cases are classed as practically hopeless. There are 10 alcoholics who have recovered, but who are out of touch with the group. There are at present over 25 prospects. Mr. Parkhurst also reported on Mr. Wilson's and his own activities toward raising funds for the foundation. Mr. Amos went into the budget and office matters for the information of the trustees. The meeting was adjourned. June 24, 1938, a letter from Frank Amos to Mr. Albert L. Scott, who is a member of the Lockwood Green Engineers Incorporated, 30 Rockefeller Plaza. "Dear Mr. Scott, since your return, I have wanted an opportunity to tell you in detail the developments and the activities of the self-styled Alcoholics Squad, both here and at Akron. The work has been going on splendidly, and every day evidences are piling up, which strengthen my conviction that these fellows not only are on the level, but have developed a Christian technique which, if earnestly followed out, is and can be effective in a majority of the cases of this character. There are 2 things that these men are particularly anxious about. One is that along carefully worked out logical lines, their influence can gradually be spread to other parts of the country. The second is that they can gradually become self-supporting so far as this particular work is concerned. I have been in constant consultation with the leaders here and just recently paid a brief visit to Akron, spending my entire time with Dr. and Mrs. Smith and Paul Stanley. Smith and Stanley were 2 of the group whom we met in our original meeting." And this was before the Rockefeller meeting where Bill and others were disappointed. "After securing a great deal of expert advice from various quarters, including 2 writers of national reputation, they have decided to bring out a book. They hope that the revenue from the sale of this book will be of material financial assistance. Their desire is to have this as a cross-section of experiences from a large number of the group, selecting only those who have been in this work long enough to convince the leaders that they are permanently cured and therefore good practical examples. The idea is for the book not to bear the name of any author, but to be by Alcoholics Anonymous. They figure that it may take a year to complete it, and they have offers to have it carefully edited by two writers of national reputation, one of whom is Floyd Parsons, providing this proves desirable. It is hoped that endorsements of the book and of this work can be incorporated in it over the names of at least one outstanding physician of national reputation, and at least one person who is likewise well known, thus adding great strength and authenticity of what the book contains. I'm sending you a rough draft of the first dictation. The first page is not to be part of the book, but is outlining the purposes of it. The rest is a rough beginning on chapter one and on the first story of an ex-alcoholic. If you can spare the time and strength, I wish you would read this, if possible, within the next few days and let me know what you think of it. In fact, if you can spare the time, I should like to come over and discuss the matter with you for a half hour or so. I am more than ever impressed with the sincerity and the practical ability of these gentlemen, and believe it is well worth our while to back it up in every possible manner. Sincerely, Frank B. Amos. Frank was on the board when I came. He was a very kindly gentleman, tall, slender, quiet, but one of the real builders, one of the real founders of this fellowship. I don't have the day of the month or the day of the month of this letter, but it was 1938 and written by Bill to Dr. Bob. Dear Bob, I have been most remiss, but there have been reasons. After getting home from Akron, I had about concluded to let the book idea lie quiet while people thought it over. I found, however, that a lot of people, including Frank Amos, had got quite a fire. Frank thought something ought to be started right away. I told him that you people had only just begun to consider the matter and pointed out at length the dangers and difficulties of such a venture, particularly our fear of undesirable publicity. Considering the rate at which we grow, he and others, including myself, began to think that publicity would come anyhow. Why then not our own anonymous view of ourselves, thus precluding the possibility that someone else garbles the situation before we have a chance to say anything? Thus, we came to the conclusion that in a tentative way, a beginning should be made. In this fashion, having some definite proposals laid out and some writing done, we would have a concrete basis for discussion. As a starting point, I have, with the help of the folks here, dictated and mimeographed two chapters of the proposed book, one in the nature of an introduction and the second my own story. These I enclose to you together with a rough outline of the contents of other chapters. The foregoing are suggestions only. This is the first time I recall having seen the word suggestions come up. We can never tell where the next best idea may come from and who will make a still better suggestion. So please take the picture I have sketched and do not hesitate to add, subtract, or multiply it in any way which occurs to you all. I'm not suffering at the moment from any pride of authorship, so let everyone do their best and, if they like, their worst. It might be a good idea if you showed this stuff around generally and then asked people to write their own stories in their own language, and at all the length they want, covering those experiences from childhood up which illustrate the salient points of their character. Probably emphasis should be placed on those qualities and actions which cause them to come into collision with their fellows, and those things which lay beneath the tendency to excessive drinking. The queer state of mind and emotion preceding the first drink, the first medical attention required, the various institutions visited, these ought to be brought in. There ought to be a description of the man's feelings as he met our crowd, his first sense of God being with him, his feeling of hopelessness, and now his sense of victory, his application of principles to his everyday life, including domestic, business, and relations with other alcoholics, the release he gets from working with others, the victories God has given him, the problems which still face him, and his progress with them, These are other possible points. When this is done, we can sit down with these authors one at a time and fit their story into the pattern of the book. Everyone should write with feeling, not laying it on too thick, however. And above all, let's not try to be too literary. It'll be much better to be guided. What would you think about the formation of a charitable corporation to be called, let us say, Alcoholics Anonymous? I can't read that other. Yeah, money coming in from the book could be handled through it, as well as any funds arising from contributions by corporations benefited by our work. We should always remember that perhaps someday our activities will be scrutinized by hostile microscopes with the idea of proving we're a racket. If we now form a corporation whose control is exercised by a board composed largely of disinterested non-alcoholic people, we shall have closed the door to such criticism. The trustees of this corporation could administer any other enterprises we might want to engage in, such, for example, as sanitariums. 1938. It is expected that we can obtain from friends of Frank Amos suitable to whom it may concern letters introducing us to people of means. The plan is to approach such people saying that we need funds to carry on our general work and to publish this book. They will be shown chapters of the book and will be told that we intend to become self-supporting within a year, but that we shall need financial assistance in the meantime. So we're hard at work in the money department out here, and I have no doubt that we shall raise what we need. When this is accomplished, some of us will probably come out for a visit, at which time we can develop matters further. Meanwhile, salutations to the alcoholic brethren, and God be with you all. P.S. I can't say how soon I shall get to Akron, for we're in the throes of raising more money to carry on with. But if you could get the ball rolling along these lines, it would be great. This would much facilitate tying up the packages quickly and neatly later on. Now about money matters. In the first place, I'm sure we could use quite a bit to carry on the general work for the next year. Situations are bound to arise which will need some underpinning. Moreover, it's going to take time and money to get this book out and put it in circulation. In this latter connection, we're told by Silas Bent that if we can produce a book as useful and as moving as the first two chapters suggest, it may have a very large sale. You will remember Silas as an alcoholic we worked with out here. He is a star reporter and writer and was at one time editor of the New York Times Sunday Magazine. He thoroughly knows all the ropes we shall need and offers his services as an editor or as a writer if we so desire. He thinks that prior to the publication of the book, articles based upon it should be published in the Reader's Digest, Saturday Evening Post, and so forth, or perhaps some of the chapters of the book itself. This would ensure a very large sale of the volume if it's any good. We think we can get some of the life insurance companies to recommend in their advertising that people read the book. By the way, you might all be thinking up a good title. Nearly everyone agrees that we should sign the volume, Alcoholics Anonymous. Titles such as Haven, 100 Men, Comes the Dawn, and so forth have been suggested. January 4, 1939. Mr. Frank B. Amos. Dear Frank, quite a bit has happened in the alcoholic department since the last meeting of the foundation. I shall endeavor herewith to bring you up to date and set forth the problems which most concern us at the moment. This is from Bill. As you know, our book, 100 Men, is nearly complete. But considerable editorial work may yet be necessary, and in that connection, the manuscript has been placed in the hands of Thomas H. Uzel, a noted literary critic and writer. Because of his interest in our work, his charge will be modest. One more consultation with the boys in Akron will be necessary, so I hope to get out there soon. Assuming no unforeseen difficulties, the book should be in the hands of our printer about March 1st. It may be asked, why not sooner? The answer is that the organization of publicity, the raising of funds, procuring of prominent persons to vouch for the book, and the possibility of considerable revision will easily consume this time. You will remember that we made strenuous efforts last summer to secure private contributions by which to carry on our work, maintain an office and secretary, and afford me time to write. These efforts proved unexpectedly disappointing, and broadly speaking, we were then faced with the question of whether to let the matter drift, those of us particularly concerned returning to business, whether I should accept the offer of Harper Brothers, which would enable me to write the book, but which would provide no means of taking care of its aftermath, or whether we should permit Mr. Charles Townes to contribute further, undertaking the publication of the book ourselves and financing this latter activity by stock subscription. You'll remember that Charles Townes was the proprietor of Townes Sanitarium, where Bill shook it out on several occasions, and where Dr. Silkworth was the medical director. After consultation, the last mentioned course was adopted. Mr. Townes has subsidized me at the rate of $200 per month, plus $100 more per month for the secretary who has worked with me. Stock was offered at the rate of $25 per share in a company to be known as 100 Men Corporation. The proceeds of the stock issue to take care of our office expense, Hank Parkhurst, and the promotional requirements of the book. I'm glad to say that our efforts along these lines have been fairly successful. Our course has met with general approval, and practically all of the stock subscription money thus far has come from members of our own group, who in most cases are paying for their shares on the basis of 5 monthly installments. Many 1, 2, and 5 share lots have been taken in this fashion. People have been very loyal about keeping up their payments. You will remember that subject to a royalty of 35 cents per book payable to the Alcoholic Foundation, Mr. Townes is to be paid off first. Then the cash subscribers for stock are to have their money returned. And if there's anything left after that, the stockholders, Mr. Parkhurst and myself, will receive the proceeds as dividends. This arrangement has enabled us to finish the book and somehow or other to squeak by, though we were near to being dispossessed over at Newark on several occasions. But now, assuming that the book is any good, I feel our position is much improved. People who are going to provide the money by which this job is to be completed, those persons who will write a foreword for the book, and those publications in which we seek articles can now see precisely with what they deal. Less than ever before is it a question of dealing with individuals. The book which records the experience of all of us will either stand on its own feet or it will not. Those whose interest we solicit can now judge intelligently whether our proposals are entitled to their favorable consideration. The problems coming before the trustees at this time may be resolved into 4 main categories. Here they are. First, securing a proper publicity in such periodicals as Reader's Digest, Saturday Post, Good Housekeeping, and so forth. 2, to persuade suitable persons of prominence to read our book, investigate our situation, and vouch for our work in a preface to the volume. 3, to secure funds in an amount which we estimate at $2,500, to pay printing costs, to maintain an office and staff to handle the large number of inquiries and problems which the book will undoubtedly provoke. Something about that later, which is interesting. 4, to consider in detail and to lay down guiding principles and policies which we ought to bear in mind after the appearance of the book. Let's consider how we stand right now on each one of these points. Take publicity. Last fall, Hank and I had an hour's talk with Mr. Payne, chief editor of the Reader's Digest. At the time, he inspected 2 chapters of the book which were then available. He saw nothing to which he could take exception and appeared to be most enthusiastic. He promised to place a staff writer on the job when we thought it a proper time and spoke of giving us considerable space. We have commenced to stir up this situation once more. Dr. Silkworth of Towns Hospital rents a house of Mr. Wallace, owner of the Reader's Digest. The doctor feels that he's favorably known to Mr. Wilcox, business manager of that publication. We've just given the doctor a manuscript of the book, which he expects to present through Mr. Wilcox to Mr. Wallace, urging upon him the desirability of this article and vouching for what he has seen in this hospital. A few days before our approach to Mr. Payne, Hank and I, along with Mr. Wainwright Evans, a writer, called upon Mr. Bigelow, editor of Good Housekeeping. After hearing our story, Mr. Bigelow asked Mr. Evans to prepare an outline for an article, which he did. Mr. Evans has since communicated with Mr. Bigelow, who, though by no means unfavorably disposed, wants some questions answered. He points out that we're anonymous. If, therefore, his magazine receives a flood of inquiries, to whom shall he refer them? And how are these inquiries going to be used? And are these results what Messrs. Parkhurst and Wilson claim them to be? Furthermore, is there going to be a continuity to the work? What's going to be done for or said to the distressed people who write asking for an answer? Of course, we can't answer all these questions yet because we do not know what our finances will be or what the trustees think should be done. Mr. Charles Towns has been in touch with the American Medical Association, to which he wrote a long letter setting forth his observation of our work and enclosing the last chapter of our book. An official of the association replied, evincing great interest indeed, but he wanted to know what sort of an organization we were, who the officers were, what we used for money, and where Mr. Towns figured in. Mr. Towns asked me to help him draft a reply, which stated in effect that there was no organization in the conventional sense of the word, that for the past 4 years the work had been financed by the alcoholics themselves, that recently the Alcoholic Foundation had been formed to administer matters of money and so forth, that the majority of trustees of that foundation were disinterested and well known in New York City, that a few modest donations had been made to the foundation, that the work would never be on a fee or professional basis, that outsiders could not deal with this group in financial matters touching the work without approval of the trustees, and finally, that Mr. Towns had advanced certain monies to promote publication of the book, but that Alcoholics Anonymous had not obligated themselves to him in any way, except for the return of his money, that Mr. Towns hoped and expected his business would increase on account of our group, because men in it had taken his treatment and liked it, and would probably recommend that others do likewise if the occasion warranted. Mr. Towns stated explicitly that was his only relationship with it, and that he saw no reason why it should ever be any different. He also added that the Towns treatment was in use in Akron with his consent, but at no profit to himself. Hank Parkhurst has mapped out an extensive program which can be used to promote the sale of the book. He has also laid out office procedure and a system for handling inquiries. So, subject to the advice of the trustees, we're prepared to go ahead with the publication of the book and are organized to take care of the mail which will come in. Provided, of course, we have the means to do it, and it seemed the desirable thing to do. The problem of securing the right person or persons to authenticate our book seems of immediate and paramount importance. Assured of the support of the right people in this regard, we ought to get anything we need in the way of publicity, and we can much more readily raise the $2,500 which will be needed to print the book and to maintain the status quo until book royalties and contributions to the Alcoholic Foundation take up the slack. It may take time to secure such an endorsement, and obviously publication of the book will have to wait upon it. Mr. Ford, Dr. Correll, the Mayo brothers, Dr. Fosdick, and similar names have been mentioned, but little has been done in this direction. The discussion of such names and the manner of approach should perhaps be one of the main considerations of the next foundation meeting. Now, what about the sinews of war? To get the book printed, to continue our office and so forth, will require $2,500. Equivalent to the sale of 100 shares of stock in the book corporation. There is outstanding at the present time 109 shares, of which 93 shares have been subscribed for in cash. But it must be remembered that most of the subscriptions are on the partial payment plan and have dribbled in at a rate which has barely kept us going. We are at the point, therefore, where we need a chunk of money on the barrelhead. This means we have to find spot cash buyers for 100 shares, which I think we can do when the publicity and authentication matters are settled, if not before. Touching money, another alternative presents itself. Suppose we could find, for example, a public-spirited person or persons who would agree to buy at, let us say, half price, 5,000 or 10,000 books. These books might be distributed by the buyer to ministers, doctors, or hospitals, of which there are 6,000 to 7,000 in the United States. Or, again, they might be placed in the libraries, or perhaps better still, in hotel rooms along with the Gideon Bible. this last might be the best bet of all, for almost every man of us has passed hours of terror and depression in those lonely cubicles. Under these conditions, the book would hit the man at the most receptive moment, and it would be introduced accidentally instead of by another person. The approach in those places would be perfect. Granted a firm order from people of unquestioned credit, we could easily persuade a printer to undertake the work without any money in advance, and to raise funds on the sale of stock with such an order in hand would be nothing. So possibly some thought should be given to a list of people who might be approached on this basis. An order of this kind would resolve all our difficulties in one fell swoop. It would put the whole venture in the clear and enable us to pay off Mr. Towns and the cash subscribers for stock. Further royalties and profits from the book would then be immediately applied to the work without having to make these deductions. When the book is published, many matters of policy should already be in effect. Will the Alcoholic Foundation maintain an office? Shall its address and the names of the trustees be disclosed? In our literature, shall we make any public appeal, either expressed or implied, for funds? How shall the detail of the foundation work be administered? In the book itself, shall we invite people to write to the Alcoholic Foundation or the publishing company? Shall the activities of the foundation and the publishing company be consolidated or kept separate? How can we be helpful to Mr. Towns within strict ethical limits? For he has certainly played fair with us. Publicity, authentication, money, and policy. Upon these things, we would very much like the help and advice of the trustees. This was Frank Amos. January 5, 1939. To William G. Wilson, Dear Bill, from Hank Parkhurst. I'm rushing off to you excerpts from a letter just received from Mr. Thomas H. Uzzell, former editor of Collier's Magazine, writer of several books, contributor to Collier's, Saturday Evening Post, and so forth. As you know, hardly a year goes past when one of Mr. Uzzell's writers does not appear on the bestsellers list. Incidentally, this might be interesting to you. Such books as The Good Earth, If I Had Four Apples, The Outward Room, three Book of the Month Club books, and bestsellers for months after publishing were submitted to him for criticism and final designing. In the publishing and literary world, I know there is no one so well established and looked up to as Mr. Uzzell. I've gone into considerable length in regard to this because the following portion of his letter has made me so enthusiastic. He says, quote, I spent last evening with the manuscript. I knew, of course, what the document was, but on reading additional chapters and surveying the job as a whole, I found myself deeply moved, at times full of amazement, almost incredulity, and during most of the reading I was extremely sympathetic. My feeling at the moment is that you should certainly hold on to the production and distribution of this volume if you can, for she ought to go far. She ought to go far, wide, and handsome, and net those concerned a neat profit. You have here an extremely urgent problem. You have a successful defiance of medicine. You have a religious story. You have a deeply human story. And lastly, you have a whole flock of happy endings. My God, I don't know what else you'd want for a good book. I believe in it most emphatically. He further says, the whole book needs the final shaping of a professional hand. And he then goes on at considerable length into mechanical details with which I will not bother you. But it's interesting that he ends his letter as follows. I understand better now the enthusiasm you revealed in your talks with me about this work. I thought you were exaggerating somewhat, but now I have joined the choir invisible. If I were you, I would be intensely proud of this opinion. Apparently, Hank Uzzell wasn't too modest. Now, the final long thing that I will read is particularly interesting because it is a letter which Ruth Hawks, who was the first secretary at the office, wrote to Bill in 1955 when he asked her to send to him some of her recollections of the early days in the office. She says, Dear Bill, As I wrote to you last week, it's difficult for me to get a long period of uninterrupted time together to put down my recollections of those old AA days. But I have about 2 hours, so here goes. Let me say first that I do not guarantee the accuracy of any dates I may use until I have the opportunity to check one thing against the other, which I am willing to do if it ever proves necessary. Neither do I insist that my memory is absolutely accurate. It will be easier if I can just sort of meander along for present purposes. As I remember it, you had been sober just a little over a year when I first met you. I think I went to work for Honor Dealers in about January of 1936. Honor Dealers was an outfit that Hank Parkhurst had put together, and Hank let them use his office over in Newark for some time. The job I applied for was as secretary to sort of a distributorship for a group of service stations. Naturally, I had no idea what a surprise fate had in store for me and what a change it would make in my personal life, in my relations to and my opinions of my fellow man. I walked into the Honor Dealer's office in Newark, New Jersey on William Street one Monday morning, was interviewed by Hank, and started to work immediately that morning. My immediate impression of Hank was that he had a vibrant personality, that he was capable of strong likes and dislikes, and that he seemed to be possessed of inexhaustible energy, and that he liked to make quick decisions. You arrived shortly thereafter, Bill, bringing with you an aura of quiet, warm friendliness, of slow, deliberate decisions, and at least I thought at that time not much interest really in the service station business. By the end of that very first day, I was a very confused female. For if I remember correctly, that first afternoon, you had a visitor in your office, and I think it was Paul Kellogg. Anyway, the connection door was left wide open, and instead of business phrases, what I heard was fragments of a discussion about drunken misery, a miserable wife, and what I thought was a very queer conclusion indeed, that being a drunk was a disease. I remember distinctly feeling that you were all rather hard-hearted because at some points there was roaring laughter about various drunken incidents. Fortunately, I liked you both immediately. I'm not too easily frightened, and you were paying $3 more a week than I'd been getting, so I was willing to give it a try. You will remember with me, I know, that in those days and for several years to come, we talked about drunks and not alcoholics. And therefore, I use those terms here. The activity of Honor Dealers, as I remember it, was never of paramount importance. It seemed to me, after I began to know most of you original men, that it was only a means to an end, that end being to help a bunch of nameless drunks. Having come from a thrifty German family, I know that I thought if you two would spend as much energy and thought and enthusiasm on Honor Dealers as you did on drunks, you might get somewhere. That would be hard to prove either way, and actually I've never known whether the original premise of all Honor Dealers was sound. Anyway, I soon stopped caring whether Honor Dealers was successful or not, and became more and more interested in each new face that came along with the alcoholic problem, and caring very much whether they made the grade or not. All of you made me feel as though I were a very worthwhile person in my own right, and very important to you, which in turn made me want to always give my best to all of you. To me, that's part of the secret of the success of AA, the generous giving of oneself to the needs of the other. Well, the activities of Honor Dealers slowly but surely declined, and there was more and more correspondence with drunks, and more of them popping up in the office. In those days, it was part of the procedure, if the new prospect was willing to go along, to kneel and pray together. All of you happened to be there. To me, drunkenness and prayer were both very private activities, and I sure did consider all of you a very revolutionary lot. But such likable and interesting revolutionaries. Hank put a good deal of thought and effort into Honor Dealers, but whether his ideas had real merit or whether there was not enough prolonged effort, or whether it was just a poor time for that kind of an idea, I was not capable of judging them then, nor am I now. I only know that within about a year, finances were precarious enough to move us into a tiny office in the same building. And even then, I was front man to explain to the superintendent why the rent wasn't paid on time, and the telephone bill, and so forth. Payday was an indefinite affair indeed. I'm somewhat confused about the timing of the move into the small Newark office, because now that I think about it, I remember that the bookwork was done in the large office. Anyway, early in my association with you, Bill, you began to dictate letters to Doc Smith. You never liked to dictate to a shorthand notebook. You always dictated directly as I typed. In the amazing way these things often happen, since word of what you fellows were doing in New York, and by that time Doc Smith in Akron, was simply spread vocally from mouth to mouth. Inquiries began to float in from amazing distances, and some of these you asked me to answer in my own fashion. That is, to refer them to the closest educated drunk. Educated, of course, in the sense that they knew something of this new possibility of an answer to alcoholism. Somewhere during those first months, I also first met Doc Smith, who gave everyone a feeling of great serenity, peace with himself and God, and an abounding wish to share what he had found with others. Somewhere along in there, John Henry Fitzhugh Mayo also appeared. Offhand, I have no idea of those dates. With his warm sense of humor and the all-abiding wish to give to other drunks what he too had found, this you all had in common to an exciting and unbelievable degree. During that first year, at least, I don't think I ever attended a meeting. But through your dictation, Bill, through all I heard at the office, and through the letters I was answering myself in your behalf, I began to absorb an understanding of what it was all about and what you were trying to do. And I became aware that the possibilities of writing a book were being discussed. Many of you thought it was an absolute necessity, because even then the original idea was often distorted in the hundreds of word-of-mouth discussions. Its original basic simplicity was often completely confused beyond comprehension, and besides, it was becoming more and more impossible to fully expound the idea satisfactorily in letter after letter to various inquirers. Also, especially to the advertising type of mind, the spread of the idea was going much too slowly and would become a sensation overnight if only put out in book form. So far as I know, there was never any doubt but that you were the one to write it, Bill. And I know that you spent endless hours discussing its general form with everyone who would listen or offer an idea, especially with Doc Smith, Fitz, and Hank. As soon as you began to feel that you had at least a majority agreement, you began to arrive at the office with those yellow scratch pad sheets I came to know so well. All you generally had on those yellow sheets were a few notes to guide you on a whole chapter. My understanding was that those notes were the result of long thought on your part after hours of discussion pro and con with everybody who might be interested. That's the way I remember first seeing an outline of the 12 steps. See, I get the feeling from this of the way in which this whole thing was hammered out. And that I knew it had happened that way, but I never got quite the feel of it as I have in reading this material. As I look at it today, the basic idea of each chapter of the book and the 12 steps is still essentially today what you scribbled on the original yellow sheets. Of course, there were thousands of small changes and rewrites, constant cutting or adding or editing, but there are only two major changes made that I remember both fought out in the office when you and Hank and Fitz and I were present. The first had to do with how much God was to be included in the book itself and the 12 steps. Fitz was for going all the way with God. You were in the middle. Hank was for very little, and I, trying to reflect the reaction of the non-alcoholic, was for very little too. The result of this was the phrase, God as you understand him, which I don't think ever had much of a negative reaction anywhere. We were unanimous that day, and you got a green light everywhere you showed that typewritten copy, including Doc Smith and the Akron contingent, where a copy of everything was sent for okay or criticism. The only other major change I remember during the actual writing of the book was that originally it was directly written to the prospective alcoholic. That is, quote, you were wrong, you must, you should. And after a big hassle, this was changed to read, we were wrong, we must, we should, and so forth. This was quite a job, because by the time this major revision was decided on, most of the book had been finished in its first draft at least, and each chapter as well as the 12 steps had been slanted toward you instead of we to begin with. Now what a difference that made. At this time, I had still attended very few meetings, but I know that the office confabs and final decisions were only made after the aforementioned hours of discussion with all who cared to take part in them, with you, so that the majority opinion of all who attended meetings at that time was reflected in the final decisions. During all this time, of course, there was plenty of discussion about a name for the book, and there were probably hundreds of suggestions. However, I remember very few. 100 Men, The Empty Glass, The Dry Way, The Dry Life, Dry Frontiers, The Way Out. This last was by far the most popular. Alcoholics Anonymous had been suggested and was used a lot among ourselves as a very amusing description of the book group itself. But I don't believe it was seriously considered as a name for the book. More later on this. By the time the book was mimeographed, mostly for distribution in an effort to raise money to carry on and get the book published, there was constant discussion about detailed changes with seemingly little hope for unanimous agreement, so it was finally decided to offer the book to Tom Uzel for final editing. It had been agreed, for one thing, that the book as written was too long, but nobody could agree on where and how to cut it. At that point, it was still nameless because Fitz had reported that the selected name of The Way Out was over-patented. Another lucky bit. At our original appointment with Tom Uzel, we discussed the various name possibilities, and he immediately, very firmly and enthusiastically, stated that Alcoholics Anonymous was a dead ringer, both from the sales point of view, because it was catchy, and because it really did describe the group to perfection. The more this name was studied from this point of view, the more everybody agreed, and so it was decided. Uzel cut the book by at least a third, as I remember it, and in my opinion did a wonderful job on sharpening up the context without losing anything at all of what you were trying to say, Bill, and the way you said it. I really cannot remember who originally thought up the name Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's a footnote here that Joe Worden, an AA member who just couldn't stay sober, was a writer for the New Yorker magazine. He claimed authorship of the Alcoholics Anonymous name. The financing of the book is quite difficult for me to remember. That is, what happened when. Originally, of course, the work was done on honor dealer time. In other words, what salaries were paid came from honor dealer transactions. And the paper, the pencils, the office, the typewriter, the phone, and so forth belonged to honor dealers. Let me make it clear that the members of honor dealers were never cheated in any way. They were always promptly served. It's only that what might have been a worthwhile idea for a group of service stations just didn't pan out. When the income from honor dealers finally dwindled away completely, finances were a real problem. At this point, there was universal agreement, except in Cleveland, that the book was a necessity and that what you'd done on it up to that time was extremely satisfactory, both in concept and execution. So the only problem was how to get enough money to finish it and get it published. You went to one of the large book publishers about in advance, and as I remember it, you were offered $1,000 with a rather minute royalty on each book published. Hank, I think, then came up with the idea of selling stock to finance the writing of the book and to publish it. Thus, Works Publishing Company was born, and the book stock idea set up and forms printed. Most of you remember, I think, that the AAWS used to be known as Works Publishing. There was great optimism about the ease with which this stock could be sold by you and Hank and Wally Von Arks, who was active in this phase of the situation. That dream was not to be fulfilled because, for the most part, selling a share of Works Publishing Company stock for $25 per was like pulling teeth. Enough stock was sold in the original enthusiastic reaction of a few to keep us going on an extremely minimum basis for a while. Excuse me. And then sales came to a complete halt, and there we were back where we started. The paradox of this is the fact that if enough stock had been sold and the book carried through to a conclusion on this basis, the stockholders would have had a fine return indeed for their original investment. However, all things happen for the best, and this kind of private profit would probably have been a perpetual thorn in the AA side. You then decided to approach Mr. Rockefeller and were able to do so through various contacts you had built up through the years. This resulted in the Rockefeller dinner, which in turn resulted in the minimum pledge, which finally resulted in the book being carried to conclusion and finally published by the Cornwall Press. Unfortunately, I'm not very good at getting across the spirit of fun, the real enjoyment of life, the cheerful acceptance of temporary defeat, the will to keep trying, the eternal effort to keep everybody satisfied, which made these years so very worthwhile and so soul-satisfying. In this paragraph, I'm describing particularly my own reactions, but I know that you'll agree, and so would everyone else who had any share in it. Even the altercations and disagreements, of which there were many, were carried on with a basic will to reach a compromise at least. Therefore, a compromise was always possible and always reached amicably. Tradition began early, didn't it? Naturally, when the book was finally rolling off the press, the feeling was that our troubles were over, which turned out to be far from the case. It was agreed that the book needed to be advertised, and the spot was finagled for a member of AA on We the People. Morgan Ryan agreed to appear anonymously and did a good job with his 3 minutes, while we all listened breathlessly on the radio. As I remember it, his talk was slanted at doctors, and to back him up, we had mailed out thousands of postal cards to a selected list of doctors to reach them in time to get them to listen to the broadcast and to tell them how to get a copy of the book. We had an assembly line all ready to pack and mail the books when the orders came rolling in, and then we waited. I don't think more than 4 cards were returned at all, and the only one that made an impression on me was the first one that came in. An order for 6 books, COD. There was great jubilation that morning. Naturally, we thought we were in. We simmered down to as close to gloom as I ever remember we got in the next few days over the few replies, and were really practically squashed flat when the package of 6 books was returned marked, "No such address." I'm afraid none of us appreciated for a while the humor of whoever that joker was. By this time, we were at the Vesey Street office, and that address was a compromise, too. Since I lived in New Jersey, I didn't want to work in New York at all. On the other hand, you'd always wanted to have the office near Grand Central Station. So we settled on Vesey Street. For quite a while, about a year at least, there were just the two of us, handling correspondence, packing books, and whatever there was to be done, and all the while the financial struggle to keep the thing going at all continued. The Liberty Magazine article was published, and for the first time we began to find a stirred-up interest in the form of mail. Each letter was answered individually, and although the book was mentioned, we tried to get across the fact that it was not necessary to purchase the book, and in each case the individual was referred to whatever group or individual AA closest to him or her. Since at that time I imagine there were no more than 500 AA members, if that, scattered from coast to coast, and the great majority of those in the Middle West and East, it was often difficult to get any closer to the individual than several hundred miles. However, we did the best we could, and we soon fortunately began to be able to count several traveling salesmen among our AA members. Outstanding among these was Greenberg, who often made side trips of several hundred miles to try to contact people who had written to our New York AA office for help. When the Saturday Evening Post article hit the stands, we really began to be flooded with mail. And meanwhile, the book sales had been steadily increasing from 2 or 3 a week until I think they hit an average of about 25 a week, and we began to be able to meet office expenses. We then had to hire an assistant who turned out to be Lorraine Green, who was promptly christened Sweetie Pie by you, Bill, and I don't think was ever called anything else by anyone connected with AA. I'd like to say that Sweetie Pie was always cheerful and loyal and understanding beyond her years, and was a real asset to those early days of the AA office at Vesey Street. To me, some of the things that stand out most were letters from individuals who were too far distant to contact any AA group or member, but who kept writing back to us and with the help of the book were able to reach sobriety by themselves and even to start their own groups. To keep us humble and laughing were developments like the Southern group started by mail through, was his last name Henry?
Anyway, he wrote us glowing reports about his own progress and the growing number of members in his group. One of our traveling members stopped in for a visit, and his letter to us was an eye-opener indeed. It seems that his particular group was based on the theory that all alcoholic beverages were very bad for the alcoholic, except beer. This idea was carried out so thoroughly that beer was served at their AA meetings copious readings of the AA book. Oh well, the beer itself soon cured that misconception. One of the biggest things you ever did for the solid growth of AA, in my opinion, Bill, was to set a policy of non-interference in the development of individual groups. You set up a policy of suggestion, not direction, with which I agreed all the way and which I always followed. An individual or a group can resent and argue an order or direction, but how much can you resent a suggestion which carries the intimation that possibly they might come up with a better answer if they work it out for themselves? In other words, if a group wrote us a description of a problem in their midst and asked for an answer, we would usually describe what another group had done under similar circumstances, or suggest possibilities and put the problem squarely back in their laps. In other words, as each individual is responsible for his own sobriety, so is each group. We learned early, too, not to make predictions about who would or would not stay sober. The most impossible-looking cases so often made the grade to confound us with the miracle, while our most promising so often fell by the wayside. Do you remember the two young hopefuls we practically made bets on? I think they were Mac and Shepard. They contacted us about the same time and were especially interesting because they were younger than most at that time. As I remember it, Shepard was a high betting favorite, while poor Mac was hopeless. To our surprise, Shepard at that time had trouble almost immediately, while Mac seemed to make steady progress in sobriety. Of course, the whole situation blew up in our faces when one day Mr. Chipman promised to visit us at Beezy Street so that you could show him what wonderful progress AA was making in every way. And to top off the performance, you invited Mac to appear to prove that even very young men could achieve sobriety. The stage was all set, and you met Mr. Chipman for lunch. Meanwhile, Mac appeared at the office completely polluted for the first time in about 6 months. Unfortunately, he was so far gone that he collapsed in a coma in the big chair in your private office. I couldn't budge him. So all I could think of to do was to shut the door and try to head you off. When you appeared with Mr. Chipman, though, you were talking a blue streak, complete with gestures, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise. So you swept open the door to your office to reveal Mac in all his drunken glory. After the proverbial moment of stunned silence, you broke into roars of laughter, and a minute later, bless his heart, Mr. Chipman joined you. Then I relaxed, too, and all three of us laughed until we literally wept. When Mac snapped out of this particular binge some days later, he enjoyed it, too. This ability to laugh at yourselves and to accept the puncturing of your own self-importance is one of the basic steps in AA, I believe. Of course, it makes every individual more livable and lovable, whether alcoholic or not. What little I've been able to absorb has made life much simpler for me, I know. I'm going to quit right here, Bill. If it isn't the kind of thing you want, tear it up. If there's anything I can or should add or subtract, let me know. All the best to you. Devotedly, Dutch. Bill's first secretary. And here's another bit of early tradition that the trustees haven't entirely followed, but there's a good deal of it, too. To all AA groups, a request by the trustees of the Alcoholic Foundation that their activities and policies be reviewed by the groups. All members have just received a leaflet describing the work of the Alcoholic Foundation and our AA central office here at New York City. This office, opened by the trustees of the Alcoholic Foundation in 1939, has looked after our national affairs since then. As most AA groups now contribute to the support of the central office, the trustees have naturally assumed that the activities and policies of the foundation have met with general approval. Yet, Alcoholics Anonymous has lately grown very large, 1943. And since questions might arise as to the wisdom of foundation policies now in effect, the trustees would like to be advised if these policies do, in fact, follow the wishes of the groups. To enable the groups to express their opinions on these matters, a questionnaire covering the main points is enclosed. The trustees have always taken the position, practically speaking, that they are but a service committee acting for the national welfare of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hence, an assurance from the groups, such as this questionnaire could give them, will be highly appreciated by every member of the board. The trustees are anxious that each group or group committee carefully consider these questions. Also, that this questionnaire be signed by a committee chairman or secretary. Please answer each question yes or no. When negative replies are given, the trustees will welcome alternate suggestions. The questionnaire is sent you in triplicate, one copy for your files and two signed copies to be returned to me, care of Margaret Berger at the central office. At a meeting held March 2, 1943, the trustees by resolution request that I submit the enclosed questionnaire to all of the groups. Your earnest and early cooperation will be most helpful to us. Sincerely yours, Dr. L. V. Strong, Secretary of the Alcoholic Foundation. Dr. Strong was Bill's brother-in-law. And this is the questionnaire. Does your group believe that the AA Central Office at New York is an effective and necessary part of our national program? Does your group believe that the Central Office should continue to be supported by voluntary contributions from the groups? Does your group believe that any publicity, literature, or project intended to have a national circulation or effect should first be submitted to our Central Office or to a trustee of the Alcoholic Foundation? In answering the next question, please first read a description of the fund raised from non-alcoholic sources from which grants are made to Bill Wilson and Bob Smith. Description attached. This is $2,500. I guess it's a little more than that. I think it's about $5,000 that the Rockefeller Group gave. Does your group believe, inasmuch as Bill Wilson and Bob Smith cannot fully maintain their present activity out of their own means, that the trustees should continue to procure them income from sources outside the groups? Before answering the question below, please read the brief history of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which is attached. Does your group approve the manner in which the trustees have divided the income of the book Alcoholics Anonymous? That was the questionnaire. I do not have a copy of the answers to it. I hope I haven't bored you. To me, this was fascinating and real fun. One of the things that we have been talking about lately has been the conference. The conference is coming up pretty soon. And the conference secretaries and the rest of us at the office are very anxious to get from you and people, the delegates present and past, their reaction to the conference. Sometimes it seems to some of us that have been through it a number of times, that there's a lot of routine, a lot of reporting by many different people, that over a period of the full conference can get pretty tiresome. Now, we've tried in various ways in the last few years to get the delegates' reaction to it. We have thought, in general, that the time to get the reaction is when the ideas are fresh in your minds. And yet, as we have given you questionnaires to think about this and send back to us, we appreciate your answers, but we're a little disturbed that they're all so favorable. can't be that good. And how can we get from the delegates more specific indication from them of what could be done to make this conference more valuable? Perhaps it's all right as it is. We haven't been able to come up with an idea to make it any better. One suggestion that has been most common in the last 3 or 4 years has been everybody likes the workshops. And we've tried to put them in. On the other hand, we're not entirely satisfied with them. We felt that there isn't the kind of individual interaction between the various members of the group that would be creative. In setting up the workshops, do we put in too many questions so that it takes so much time in trying to answer the specific questions that you don't interact, you don't discuss things? Those of you who were at Miami and attended the session where Dr. Herron from the Ontario Addiction Research Foundation spoke may remember that toward the end of his talk, he said, "I think that you in AA could learn some things from some of the newer experience, the newer ideas about group interaction." We have a committee, it's a small committee, which has been trying to take the place of Bill's constant thinking about the future of AA to try to be in touch with what's happening in the movement, what's happening outside the movement that could have an impact on AA, so that hopefully we could make any adjustment that needed to be made to be prepared for major changes in society around us. And at one of those meetings, we invited Dr. Herron to meet with us. It was an exciting session to me, I think it was to all of the people that were there, because in it, he told us quite a little about group interaction, showed us quite a little about it in the way in which the people at that meeting sparked each other in their thinking, in their discussions, in the things that we talked about. Okay, Wes. My voice is getting tired. I think one, possibly as I follow that idea down a little bit, one of the reasons why the questionnaire that we've sent out about the conference hasn't helped much has been that it's one person trying to put down on paper their ideas without the opportunity to to bounce an idea off of somebody else and get the feedback. Some years ago, I was a part of a big meeting. There were about 50 of us who had been given in our jobs administrative responsibility. And the topic of this particular session was communication. Now, all of us in that group were technical people. I was the only doctor in the bunch, but there were lawyers, there were chemists, directors of research labs for the big companies. All of us, people who had the benefit of considerable education and training. But the discussion leader picked two people out of the audience. One was a lawyer, the other was an engineer.
The lawyer led off his part of the discussion first, or part of the demonstration first. On the lectern in front of him were five dominoes. They were either parallel at right angles or at a 45-degree angle from the domino immediately above it. The lawyer's rules were that he could talk as long as he wanted to talk, to be sure in his mind that he had accurately described what was in front of him. I got lost on the third domino. The discussion leader broke in a couple of times and said, "This man has a much better than average command of the King's English. He's doing a much better than average job." At the end, he asked for a show of hands, how many people thought they had it all right. Out of a group of 60, there may have been 10 or 12. I think only two or three of them really had it right. The engineer followed, and his results were that he could be interrupted as many times as anybody in the audience felt it was necessary to be sure that they understood completely what he was saying. There were a couple of questions on the second domino, more on the third. And after one of the questions, the discussion leader broke in and said, "How many of you think that that was a foolish question?" And there were 15 or 20 hands went up. After the answer, "How many of you discovered it wasn't such a foolish question after all?" And there were a lot of hands went up. Well, that was the cutest demonstration that I've ever seen of the importance of two-way communication if there isn't feedback. If we don't talk with each other, if we don't discuss things, communication may be pretty poor communication, or it may not be communication at all. And this is why it's important for us to, in rather small groups, small enough so that we can talk back, small enough so that we won't be afraid to ask a question for fear that it will be thought a foolish question by the rest of the crowd. And I've wondered sometimes, as our AA groups get bigger, whether this may not be one of the reasons why we lose some of the older men and women. Can we put something into our program in some way that will keep the older men, older people, participating? Not doing Mickey Mouse jobs, not doing maid jobs, but participating in the kind of interaction that keeps us close to each other, that keeps us friendly. You know, we here, this group, are the lucky ones. Because for some reason or other, partly because of people, partly because of the group that we've been in, we have become involved. So the figures this morning, average length of sobriety of the people in this group is over 15 years. I repeat, we are the lucky ones that have continued to find in AA a way of life, a joy in living, a joy in continual growth. But some of the others miss. And how can we pass this along? And I can think of no group that has within it the knowledge and the capacity to come up with this kind of an answer any better than this one right here. We can't be satisfied. We need constantly to look at what we're doing, not necessarily to change it, but to see whether it's being done as well as it can be done. to continue to take inventory as a group, as a fellowship, in everything that we do, so that we don't become complacent, we don't become satisfied. That doesn't mean that we should be unhappy about it either. It's when we take our inventory as groups, we need to inventory the assets as well as the liabilities in the same sense that we do as individuals. But it's so easy in our delight in each other, in our delight with our way of life, to become so dissatisfied that we forget to give it away. Instead of going out, reaching out, as the early members of AA did in their sponsorship, some at least have said, if they need it bad enough, they'll come to us. As I think of the founders and of our good fortune, I wonder if you'd be willing to stand with me and remember with gratitude the founders. Would you stand? I won't think of them all, but Bill used to speak about Dr. Carl Jung and Roland, the patient that Dr. Carl Jung told he couldn't help unless he had some sort of a transforming experience. Of Ebby, of the Oxford groups, Sam Shoemaker, and the insights that Dr. Bob and Bill and many of the early members got from the Oxford movement. The Washingtonian movement, from which Bill learned so much of what to avoid, that's kept us from making the mistakes that killed that in less than 10 short years. Of Bill. And of Lois, who was in a real sense a founder. Dr. Bob. Anne, his wife. Frank Amos. Some of the others that I read about today. Of the early AA trustees, the non-alcoholic trustees, of all of the delegates who over the years have brought their own contribution, it's made up a considerable part of the strength of the movement as we see it. Of your own sponsors, who have built a part of themselves into you. We are very grateful. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dr. Jack. It had been planned that I would ask Dr. Jack prior to his beginning that he would answer questions, and then I thought perhaps not, that maybe you would be thinking of what questions to ask and miss what he was saying. And then he mentioned that his voice was giving out, and I'd already prearranged the squire would answer the questions. But Dr. Jack says he feels renewed strength. And if anyone has a question to ask Dr. Jack, now's the time. Tom?
Not a question, but Dr. Jack, I think everyone would be interested in the background of your trip, the upcoming trip to
Germany and Rome and so forth.
I'll have an alternate one, your entrance into AA.
Yeah. All right. At Central Office, 4 or 5 months ago, a letter came from Colonel Scott, who was chief of the chaplains in with the United States Army in Europe, asking for what information was available about AA and whether there was anybody who might be available to meet with the chaplains and discuss potential ways of working more effectively together. And Bob called me on the phone and asked me whether I would be available, because he thought that nobody could do, would have quite the same background and acceptance in that group as the chairman of the board. And I told him that I would do it. So, in due time, we began to get letters from Colonel Scott and others asking me whether I would be available and when I would be available and would you come. So I'm going. A week from today, I'll be on my way. And we're meeting with chaplains, and I hope some of the administrative groups in each station in Frankfurt, Kaiserslautern, Stuttgart, Nuremberg, and Berlin. I had thought and hoped that I would be one of a group, but I discovered that I'm the only one that's on the pan. And we meet from 10 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon in each of those days, one day in each city. So I don't expect to see too much of Germany. I'm leaving in the library in each place a copy of all of our literature. There will be available at each place a member of AA from someone of the groups over there. The editor of the Stars and Stripes, incidentally, is one of us. So I think it'll be kind of fun. And hopefully we will be able to smooth out, help promote, develop some understanding on the part of the chaplains and some of the other people over there of what AA is all about and how we can cooperate without affiliate. How do you do that? Last October in Bristol, England, was the first all-European convention of AA. And speaking at that meeting was the head of the Roman Catholic Church in Britain. And he was very much impressed with what he saw and heard at that meeting. And either went to the Vatican or wrote to the Vatican, spreading his enthusiasm and suggesting that it would be worthwhile for some of the AA people who were attending that meeting to go to the Vatican. And two of them went. Sackville Mallon, who was the Irishman that took AA to Ireland, was one of them, and a man named Travers, whose first name I do not know. Maybe Travers is his first name, I don't know. It's a little hard sometimes to get the whole name of an Englishman. Anyhow, they went to the Vatican. I'll tell you a story about that before I get to tell you about what they did. Some months ago, a letter came to GSO from England saying that on a certain date, a man named Roland from England would come to the office. When he came to the office, he introduced himself as Roland. He spent 3 days at the office, and when he left, nobody knew his last name. So we're anonymous. Anyhow, they went to the Vatican, were received by one of the top people in the Curia, Cardinal Wright, who has a title this long, who was, I think, Bishop of Pittsburgh at one time. Father Arupi, who was Father General of the Jesuits, and the Papal Secretary of State. And they had a private audience with the Pope, in which the Pope chatted with them and said at the end that they consider this a real apostolate. Bless them as individuals and bless AA. While they were there, they knew that I was going to be in Germany and suggested the possibility that they would be interested in talking with me. So I will be in Rome after I leave Berlin. I'm going to need all your moral support to carry the message over there so that hopefully this can be a real step ahead, both within the clergy, and you know they have real problems, but in the understanding of the Roman Catholic clergy of alcoholism. And as I talked with Father John Ford last week, he feels that my situation as a physician and as chairman of this board could be of great help in breaking down some of the misunderstandings that still exist in the Roman Church. So much for that. Maurice wants my story. I have retired to the town where I started medical practice in 1933. I was there 4 years. And as I think back to those 4 years, four of the five people who, as my patients, died were alcoholics. I think the only discussion that I had in 5 years in medical school about alcoholism was a man that was dying of cirrhosis of the liver, whose average beer consumption was 40 quarts a day. We had no further instruction about alcoholism in medical school. And at the time that I went to work for Kodak, I hated to see him coming. As a private practitioner, I could refuse to see them. But as a member of the medical staff of the Eastman Kodak Company, they were people that were our problems. Long-term employees, many of them. We had the responsibility of approving their pay if they were out supposedly ill. We'd get calls from the wives or the families or the principals of schools saying, can't you do something about this, that, or the other one who is obviously in trouble with alcohol. And I soon learned with these people that I couldn't tell them anything that they hadn't already told themselves in language that I wouldn't use. And I remember telling one of my patients in New London before I left there, says, you're wasting my time and your money. Says, I'm not doing anything for you. I could get them past some of the complications of their drinking, but they all went back to drinking and they all died. So you can understand why I wasn't especially happy when a supervisor would call up and say, here's a fellow that's been with us for 10, 15, 20, 25 years. When he's here, he's one of our best people. But he always shows up missing when things get tough and when we need him most. And then one day, one of the people that I had been struggling with and trying to be sympathetic when his wife called, came into the office and said, you haven't seen me for quite a while, have you, Doc? I said, no, Bill, where you been? Well, he handed me a little pamphlet, just one sheet of paper folded over. One of the early pamphlets of AA about this side. Said, here's how. And told me a little bit about the AA meeting in town. AA had been brought to Rochester by the Dean of Rochester Psychiatrists, Dr. Kirby Collier, who was chairman of the program committee of the American Psychiatric Association. And at the time that Bill was asked to speak to the Psychiatric Association. It's interesting the way these threads come together.
I was interested. Here's Bill, getting better and out of my hair. In spite of me. And then a little while later, one of our visiting nurses called me and said, did you know that Bert was an alcoholic? I'd been authorizing full pay for Bert for 3 months. I thought he had an ulcer. We couldn't prove it by x-ray, but he had all the symptoms, the story. He'd come to the company as a high school graduate when the color process was new. And he'd grown with the process, so that at the time that I was talking with him, he had about 125 or 30 people working in his group, including several college graduates and a couple of PhDs. And says I to myself, why shouldn't he be tense and nervous, responsible for the work of people that have had so much more education than he? Well, Mrs. Waldert said, his wife has taken their two little boys and gone back to her mother. He's been telling people that he could tell Dr. Norris anything and Dr. Norris would believe him, and that was literally true. The doctor in general agrees, believes what his patients tell him. She said, I think you'll be getting a phone call a little later today from a member of AA from one of the other plants in the city. The call came, a fellow introduced himself as Bob. He said, I'm a member of AA. I've been working with Bert for the last 3 or 4 days. He's still pretty sick, shaking it out. But Bert will be in to see you on Monday. He said, I don't know whether this is it or not. I suspect he's going to have to fall on his face once or twice more before he really gets it. But anyhow, he'll be in on Monday. Bert came in early Monday morning, and he'd gotten enough of the program so that he had told his supervisors what the problem was. They came over with him, and they told him and me together that he still had his job, but that if it happened again, he was through. 3 weeks later, Bert got drunk. And so far as he knew, he was through. But because of the kind of a man he was, because of his years of service with the company, we kept all of his fringe benefits in full force and told him that if he'd really go to AA and really work at it, get himself a job somewhere else and establish in his own mind and in ours that he was now dependable, as he had not been for quite some time, then after a few months we'd see what could be done. This was in the early spring. He got a job loading boxcars for the Clap Baby Food Outfit in Rochester, and he held that job through a long hot summer, and Rochester summers are hot and humid. But the fact that he would take that kind of a job gives you a little idea of what kind of a guy he was. And in the early fall, he went back to work. Well, Bert was my sponsor in AA. He insisted that I go to meetings, and I went to meetings with him. And one or two of those meetings were meetings where Bill spoke in Rochester. After that, when people would be sent to me from the plant, I'd talk with them. In the meantime, I tried to do all the reading that I could about alcoholism and read what was available then of Dr. Jelinek's work at Yale. I'd become somewhat familiar with Dr. Jelinek's profile of the development of alcoholism as a problem. And when people would come over, I'd try to make up my mind on the basis of this sort of history and observation, whether or not they were alcoholics. I'd describe the natural history of alcoholism to them as we understood it, show them where they were on the progression of the disease, and tell them I'd like to have them meet a friend of mine who had found his way out of the squirrel cage. And if they would agree, I'd call Bert, and he would drop whatever he was doing with the full approval of his supervision and come over, and the three of us would chat with for a few minutes. And Bert would take him out for a cup of coffee, and they'd go to an AA meeting. We made a pretty good team.
And that's the way it began, and that's how I got hooked.
What year was that?
That was 1942 or 3. So I've been around a long time.
Doctor, is Ruth Fox living?
Ruth Fox is living. She's still going strong.
Isn't by any chance living in Marietta, Ohio?
No. This is Ruth Fox, not Brunel. Ruth Fox is a psychiatrist. She was one of the first psychiatrists after Harry Thiebaud to become interested in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's been a very strong supporter of AA over the years. Quarter after 10. You've been a very patient group. Thanks a lot.